This is a download from BFM 89.9. The Business Station.
Good afternoon. You are listening to Earth Matters. I'm Lee Chui Lin. It's estimated that more than a billion people make a living from wetlands, yet wetlands are also often viewed as wasteland. And it's estimated that more than 64% of our wetlands have disappeared since 1900. In conjunction with World Wetlands Day tomorrow, I am joined now by Associate Professor Catherine Yule, an aquatic biologist, to discuss the relevance and vital role of wetlands in our collective future. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
What components make up a wetland?
Okay, basically wetlands are just areas of land that are saturated with water. So this includes all sorts of things, rivers, lakes, swamps, paddy fields, fish ponds. But the way I think of wetlands, it's basically lakes and swamps. The still waters are the important ones. In Peninsular Malaysia, this would include, there's five different categories. It would be Tasik Chini and Tasik Bera, which are the freshwater swamps created, or freshwater lakes created when the rivers flood, and then mangrove swamps, Melaleuca swamps, peat swamps, and also artificial wetlands. And in Malaysia, we have a lot. We have all the tin mine lakes, which is over 4,000, and also the dams, such as Tasik Kenya, also Klang Gates Reservoir, where we get our water from.
Out of curiosity, before we move on, I'm curious about this. Why are wetlands often viewed as wasteland? I mean, is it their appearance? Is it the fact that, you know, people don't use them as farmland? I mean, what is it?
Okay, a lot of wetlands are very hard to get into, like mangrove swamps. It's very muddy. You can walk in and just go up to your knees in mud, or peat swamps. Really hard to walk into. So people don't enter them. They're not the sort of place where they go for a picnic. And what's more, mangrove swamps are at the bottom of rivers, estuaries, and they get filled up with rubbish. All the rubbish that people throw into the rivers ends up in mangrove swamps, so they look like rubbish dumps. And so people don't value them. They don't see them as somewhere worthwhile. They don't understand the ecosystem services that these wetlands provide us.
And how do wetlands differ from each other? I would imagine that something like Tasik Chini is completely different from a tin mining,
Tin mining spot. Yeah, they're very, very different. In fact, we're really lucky in Malaysia that we have such an incredible diversity of wetlands. So, for example, Tasik Chini and Tasik Bera are just the seasonal lakes that rise and fall with the changing, with the wet and the dry season. And just the rivers kind of expand out to create a series of lakes, and then they shrink back again. So these are fresh water and very high in nutrients, and very rich, very productive. And then the artificial wetlands, also fresh water, but tin mine lakes is just depressions left behind from tin mining. Dams, Tasik Kenya is just where you dam a river and it fills up, same with Klang Gates. So these tend to have tend to be quite rich ecosystems and fresh water and lots of fish, but artificial. Then we have the mangrove swamps. These are really important to protect our coastlines. They're specialised plants, specialised trees that grow between the ocean and the land, and they protect our land because of that. And what happens is when rivers bring down sediment, they bring down mud from the mountains and things, and this gets trapped by the mangrove trees, trapped in their roots. And so the mangroves actually start building up land out seawards, so they grow and grow. They can grow 100 metres in just a few years. They grow really fast. So by having mangroves, the land of Malaysia is increasing. But these are salt water, so sort of brackish water, salt water. And so only very special species can live there. But they're very rich ecosystems because of all the nutrients coming down from the mountains. So they have fish, and they're nurseries for fish and prawns, very important. And lots of other species can live there. So these are very important. They protect us from tsunamis and storms and things. Then we have something that most people don't know about, the Melaleuca swamps. These are small areas of swamps that are found mostly in Terengganu, north of Kuantan, and they form behind sandhills and very fragile. They've got mostly Melaleuca trees growing in them, and that most of them have been destroyed actually because they are so fragile growing on sand. And they're just, people, you can't really use them for agriculture because they're sandy and acidic, but they're used for development. Then there's the peat swamps, and these are the ones that are most important in my eyes. In Indonesia and Malaysia, we have the largest extent of tropical peat swamp forests in the world. They're the largest extent, the most biodiverse, and the deepest peat. So these form where you have depressions, typically coastal behind a mangrove swamp, and the forest, because water's not flowing in, it becomes very nutrient poor, And so the trees try to conserve their nutrients. They have very tough, toxic leaves. And when the leaves fall, they fall into this anoxic still water and they don't break down. So they start building up layer upon layer of peat, and they can build up to 20 metres of peat over maybe 5,000 to 10,000 years. So we have this incredible soil of peat. It's just this brown fibrous matter with very little mineral matter in it at all. But this peat, it's actually used as a fuel. If you dry it out, you can burn it, and that's what happens when it is dried out. It burns. So we have vast areas of peat swamp in Sarawak, and also there used to be a lot around Johor. Now we just have some in Selangor and Pahang left. Most of it's all gone. It's all been cleared and drained. And it's a big shame because it's so important globally, because it's the richest terrestrial carbon store in the world. There's not just nothing else like it. And nearly all of our peat swamps have been, there's nothing pristine left, because if you drain even a tiny bit around the edge, the whole sponge of peat drains. So what's been happening is that first of all they drain them, then they cut the trees for the timber, and then they typically will burn it in order to clear the last of the waste, because that's the cheapest way. And this is why we get our seasonal fires. So we have the seasonal haze every year when they burn this peat. And it's terrible because we're losing so much carbon just going up into the atmosphere. And yet the agricultural land's not that good. Peat doesn't grow very well. It's very nutrient poor. It's very acidic. It's very unstable. If you see oil palms growing on peat, they bend over. And eventually the peat will degrade. Once it's cleared, it starts to break down because the microbes start working, and physically it just starts breaking down and burns regularly. And eventually the peat will go down, down, down until you reach the mineral soil and you can't grow anything on that. So it's unsustainable. Eventually, agriculture doesn't work on peat land. It might take 50 years, but it just won't stay as agriculture. So it's a big shame. They should just keep them as peat swamp forests.
From a scientific point of view, how does colour play a role in wetland science?
Okay, it's very interesting from my point of view. What happens when you make a cup of tea, you put tea leaves into the water and the water turns brown, and this is from the tannins coming out of the water. So where you have a still wetland, which is very still, and you don't have water coming in, when the leaves fall, it makes the water brown. So two of the wetlands that I spoke about, the Melaleuca swamps and the peat swamps, the water's brown. For simply that reason, it doesn't flow out. It's like a cup of tea. The browner it is, the more carbon is in the water, and the more acidic it is, and the more tannin-rich. And it's actually quite toxic, actually. It's like when you have a cup of tea, if you let it sit for too long, it makes you feel quite sick when you drink it because of all the tannins. So the freshwater swamps like Tasik Bera, Tasik Chini, the Tin Mine Lakes, it's also the mangroves, it's clear water, apart from if it becomes muddy from sediment. So it doesn't have this brownness to it.
I understand that wetlands can be seasonal too. Is that what you were talking about earlier with the rains and with the rising and falling?
Yeah, well, Tasik Bera and Tasik Chini are perfect examples of seasonal lakes. They rise and fall with the wet and the dry seasons. But even in the peat swamp forest, what happens is that they're always wet like a sponge. The peat is always wet. But during the rainy season, they can flood up to a metre or more above the surface of the peat. And that means that the trees in peat swamps are particularly interesting because they have to have breathing roots, they have to have stilt roots, like mangrove trees too. But mangrove, it's a tidal rise and fall. They don't have the seasonal change. Melaleuca swamps also seasonal. They get bigger in the wet season, smaller in the dry season.
So can you make a determination if the soil is wetland soil on site alone?
Well, if the soil's wet, it's probably a wetland. But it's the plants that grow on the soil that will really tell you if it's truly a wetland soil, because they have to be able to survive. So they have to have things like breathing roots and stilt roots. So that will be typical of a wetland plant.
I'm speaking today with Associate Professor Catherine Yule, aquatic ecologist, and it's in conjunction with World Wetlands Day, which is happening tomorrow. So, of course, we're talking about wetlands. Up next, we find out the functions and benefits of places like this for people as well as wildlife. You are listening today to Earth Matters on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9. Good afternoon. You are listening to Earth Matters on The Bigger Picture. I'm Lee Chui Lin. With me in the studio, Associate Professor Catherine Yule, aquatic ecologist. And we're talking about wetlands in conjunction with World Wetlands Day, which is happening tomorrow. So what are the functions and benefits of wetlands for people and wildlife?
Okay, well, globally, one of the most important functions is the fact that they store carbon. I was explaining about how peat builds up to 20 metres deep. So this dead organic material in the soil is hugely important in the global carbon cycle. So when you destroy a wetland, you're releasing all this carbon and increasing global warming. But also all the coastal wetlands are important in protecting the coasts. Tsunamis, storms, also sea level rise. As the sea levels are rising, we're going to have more and more erosion of the coast, but by having the wetlands there, that will help to protect them. The other thing is prevention of flooding. Like if Tassic Berra and Tassic Chini weren't there, then all the water would just immediately flood down the Pahang River and start flooding Kuantan. That wouldn't be such a good thing. Peats in particular, peat holds 5 to 10 times its weight in water, so it's an incredibly efficient sponge. If you clear the peat swamp forest, all the water that falls on that land will just flow down and flood any villages and towns downstream of it. And also the fact that they're like a sponge, it means they slow down flood waters. So if there is a huge downpour, it won't come all at once. So the trees keep the water, the peat holds back the water, all important. The other thing is diversity, biodiversity. We are in the tropics, which is naturally biodiverse anyway, but these wetlands are particularly interesting, the fact that we have these peat swamps that aren't found anywhere else in the world. We have species here that aren't found anywhere else in the world. My students and I have found new species of insects, new species of microbes, new species of fungi, new species of algae, and let alone that we're finding new species of trees and things like this as well. The numbers of species of fish in the peat swamps are more than the whole of Europe, so huge numbers, and some very interesting ones. The smallest fish in the world occurs in our peat swamp forests.
How small is that fish?
Oh, it could fit on your thumb and you, just across your thumb. It's like a centimetre long. It's tiny, really, really little. It wouldn't make much of a dinner. And also, one thing about the peat swamps is that they're really hard to walk into. Whenever I go in, you get covered with spines and, you know, come out covered in blood, basically, because all the trees are protected with thorns and spines and there's lots of hornets and ants and things. So it means that they're a very good refuge for endangered species because hunters and poachers don't like to go in there. So particularly in Borneo and Sumatra, there's orangutans, there's tigers, we have elephants, tapirs, leopards, rhinoceroses, all these different animals that find a refuge in the peat swamps because they're safe from hunting there. In our peat swamps, over 50% of the mammals and nearly a third of the birds are on the IUCN list of globally endangered species. So they're very important for protecting our wildlife.
That unpleasantness that you describe, you know, of walking into a wetland or a swamp and, you know, not enjoying necessarily the whole process, is that part of what makes this whole idea of making wetlands appealing? Is that part of what makes it difficult, the fact that they aren't beautiful, you know, in a sort of more mainstream, understandable way?
Oh, definitely, yes. It's not the sort of place that you can bring you know, a party of government officials and say, hey, we need to protect this because it's so lovely. You know, they can understand the charismatic animals like orangutans and things, but you wouldn't want to bring them into a peat swamp to see them because they would not appreciate that at all. So, yes, it is difficult, but, you know, it's a benefit in that it keeps people out, but it's also a problem because they don't appreciate them, definitely.
With that said, then, what is the process of trying to get people to appreciate them? Because as you say, charismatic animals are popular, you know, for a very good reason, because they're easy to relate to.
It's difficult. It really is. I mean, you have to, people have to understand that they need clean water. They need clean air. They need flood-free environments. They need the ecosystem services. They need to stop global warming. But, you know, I guess people in the Maldives, they can see global warming happening. They can see the sea level rising. But unless they actually see it and feel it and touch it, it's not always that simple. But one thing, the haze. Everybody, I think now they're not forgetting the haze between haze events, especially this last one. It was so bad. And we're going to have haze again this year. And when you are breathing in the haze particles, you're breathing in these tiny particles, you're actually breathing in peat swamp forest. You're breathing in tiny particles of peat, and it has incredibly bad health impacts. Like there's spikes in death rates when we have the haze. You know, children are dying, old people are dying, sick people who are already sick are dying. And when we can't have water for 2 days at a time, I'm hoping that people will start to value these things. And I think with the rise in the middle class, as people become middle class, they start to want clean water and clean air and a good environment, and they start to get these understandings. It's not just a scrabble for survival anymore. So I'm hoping it will turn around.
In your view, is Malaysia suffering from too much wetland loss?
Oh, it's appalling. It's so sad. It breaks my heart. It really does. It's so sad. We are losing so much, and it's getting lost before people even realise. So, yes, far, far too much loss. And the damage, you know, rehabilitation is a difficult process. Sometimes it can't be done.
And you mentioned climate change. How will climate change impact the biodiversity that we see in wetlands?
Well, a lot of the wetlands will vanish. The coastal wetlands will vanish with rising sea levels. Already, mangroves are getting eroded. Where people have cleared the peat swamp forests in parts of Sarawak and turned them into oil palms, already they're starting to flood. Normally, if you have 20 metres of peat, that's raised peat. So that means that you're preventing the sea level being able to come in because you've got higher land. But when it starts shrinking, the sea level will rise and flood, and that's what's happening. So it's happening. With regard to changing temperatures, we don't know so much about what will happen. It's hard to predict, but it probably won't be good.
Are there any species that we know of that are especially threatened?
There's a lot of species. I mean, any species that is living in a peat swamp is in jeopardy, without a doubt, because if the peat swamps are gone, most of them don't live in other habitats because it's such an extreme and unusual environment. And one group of organisms that people aren't that familiar with would be the microbes. In extreme environments, you have microbes that you don't have anywhere else in the world. Our studies have shown over 40% of microbes in North Slang or peat swamp forests are new to science. And a lot, we've already found some that produce antimicrobial compounds that are active against golden staph and other very dangerous infections. So we're going to be losing these because they can't live anywhere else because there's no other habitat like it. So, yeah, it's a big problem, let alone the orangutans. We know they're vanishing. Tigers, rhinoceros, we know they're vanishing.
You've talked a little bit about water quality and, of course, about the importance of that, especially in a place where, as you say, we've experienced water shortages. We experience these things for ourselves. Can you have good water quality without protecting wetlands?
Oh, definitely not. Definitely not. Just by destroying them in themselves, you're going to be getting, for example, you destroy the mangroves, all that mud is going to go somewhere, and typically it will go onto the coral reefs, which are offshore of the mangrove swamps. So that mud is devastating for coral reefs. Already, if you go around Port Dickson or Langkawi, coral reefs around there, they're all sediment impacted. So, yeah, it's not a good thing for our water quality, definitely not.
What are some of the things you'd like to see being done right now in order to support or protect the wetlands in Malaysia?
I think the main thing is that people need to understand the economic value of their ecosystem services, the economic value of flood protection, the economic value of no haze, the economic value of clean water and clean air, the economic value of mitigating climate change. Enormous, enormous value, far, far greater than the value that we get from timber or the value that we get from prawn farms or the value that we get from even oil palm. With these, some people get some money, but with ecosystem services, everyone on the planet benefits. So far greater benefit.
Of course, it's, you know, as we talked earlier, it's easier to see the benefit of things that are easy to understand or palatable. But for you, what is your vision for a wisely used wetland? Are we just to leave it? Is that how we best use it?
My ideal would be, yes, please just leave it. In a perfect world, we would leave it. In the past, the traditional owners used the wetlands very wisely. The Orang Asli living in Pekan peat swamp forest in Pahang, they used it very wisely. They didn't destroy it, and they still got their entire livelihoods from the forest. And we can still get benefits in terms of selective logging. We can get various forest products. We can get the microbes for bioprospecting, all this sort of thing. We can get so much from intact wetlands. So as much as possible, we should leave them. And furthermore, every wetland needs a buffer zone. not only just protecting the wetland itself, you need to have a buffer of vegetation, native vegetation around each wetland to truly protect it, to protect it from pollution, to protect it from sediment flowing in, from land clearing, that sort of thing. So, yes, I have a vision that would be very different to what's happening today.
So if we have a policymaker then who's faced with the dilemma of whether or not to grow rice or to clear out something for the sake of agriculture or for the sake of business versus conserving a wetland, what advice would you be giving him or her?
Well, I would first of all look at the world today. We have a problem with obesity, a huge problem with obesity. Do we need more rice? Actually, no. The food problem in the world today is one of distribution. There is plenty of food for everybody. There is an overabundance of food. People waste food. I think about a third of food that's produced is wasted. So no, we don't need more rice paddies. We don't need more oil palm. Yes, people want the money, but it's not the answer. We need to distribute things more fairly, definitely.
And when it comes to making these decisions, there are various knowledge tools available to different countries, available to people in the position to make changes, I think, in various countries, policymakers and so on. But would you say that the application of these tools perhaps remain a challenge?
Oh, totally. We have the answers. We do know. We do know the truth. There's scientists out there, NGOs out there. We know what should be done. The problem really is one of greed, unfortunately. I think people choose not to make the wisest decisions because it's not the decision that suits them personally the best. Their short-term financial gain tends to be the most important thing in their minds.
Finally, then, if we want to improve the state of the wetlands that we have, of the protection that they're being offered, and of, I guess, the degradation that we're currently seeing, how can we mainstream their values or mainstream their value in the decision-making process?
Well, I think all EIAs, all environmental impact assessments, need to take into consideration the ecosystem, the value of the ecosystem services. It needs to be valued, and it's not that hard to do. We have the tools to value these. It needs to be part of the process, and it needs to be part of the legislation that it's part of the process.
Thank you very much. I've been speaking with Associate Professor Catherine Yule, aquatic ecologist. Together we've been discussing wetlands in conjunction with World Wetlands Day tomorrow. You've been listening to Earth Matters on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, The Business Station.